Thank you, Baba. He smiled and leaned back against the headrest. I wish Hassan had been with us today. A pair of steel hands closed around my windpipe. I rolled down the window, waited for the steel hands to loosen their grip.
The Kite Runner was written by Khalid Husseini and read by Corvin De Geer. The producer was Jane Marshall, and you can hear part five of the story at the same time tomorrow. This weekend's feature-length drama is an adaptation of Molly Keane's Booker Prize-nominated novel Good Behaviour. We follow the life of Arun St. Charles as she explores the desires of sex, money, jealousy and love as an escape from her oppressive childhood and cruel mother.
Darling, I can't give Mrs. Brock money.
Why not?
Well, it's just not on, old chap. Can't give half sovereigns to the governors.
But why not?
Oh, don't be tiresome, Hubert.
Yeah, hell, I ought to give her something, but what?
Don't ask me, darling. I just wish she was half as successful at teaching them French as she seems to be at darning. Oh, these people are so dismal.
Le chien un jour dit au roseau.
You see, quite useless.
Starring Annette Crosby, Good Behaviour is our feature-length drama on Saturday afternoon at 4.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, The Music Room by William Fiennes, his memoir reflecting on the life of his elder brother Richard, who suffered from a severe form of epilepsy and from brain damage. He's now in his 20s, and there are periods of gentleness, but violent mood swings predominate. Meanwhile, William recollects his teenage years in the castle where he grew up. Secret places are discovered when he ventures up to the attic spaces known as the barracks. The reader is Dan Stevens.
I was happy at school. Growing in confidence. When I came home, I ran up the stairs to the barracks and made straight for the secret door. I got my fingers into the gap and prized it open. I waited while my eyes adapted to the dark, heart thumping. I could make out the shape of a second door, rimmed with light, and I walked towards it. My hands found the bolts and slid them back. I pushed the door open and stepped out into daylight. Onto a flat, leaded area among chimneys, enclosed by battlements, rooks cawing overhead. A weathered oak door to my left, like the entrance to a stone cottage on top of the house. A hermitage built on the roof. The door gave a prolonged, waning creak as I pushed it open. I stepped into an empty room. I felt like a trespasser. When soldiers had slept along the barracks, the officer in charge had had his own secluded accommodation. Now I'd found my way into it without anyone's permission. I stayed close to the door, in case anything moved, my breathing quick and shallow. The room was too ghost-amenable to relax in. I challenged myself to stand in the room for a count of 50. I counted out loud, accelerating through the 40s. Then I retraced my steps, running down the stairs, laundry cupboard doors shaking on their latches as I sped past, down again to the great hall, sprinting along the groined passage, barging through the music room door, to find it was almost 1 o'clock. An egg pie in the top oven, flagged by tin foil. Richard had been getting into trouble at the epilepsy centre. He kept having arguments. He'd punched members of staff and fellow residents. He was 25. He wasn't allowed home for Easter, after persistent bad behaviour. All the more good for me, as I wouldn't have known otherwise, he told Mum on the telephone, full of remorse. When he was at home, he moved between bed and the TV, coming downstairs with a deep-scored frown, intent on conflict, black eyebrows angled together. He threw our food into the bin and made his own. Fry-ups smoking out the ground floor, hunks of meat and cheese wedged onto the plate. He couldn't stop himself eating cheese, So Mum started hiding it. Blocks of cheddar in chests of drawers, half-stiltons among lanterns and candles. Sometimes I went with my parents when they drove Richard to the station. His dark mood hadn't entirely lifted, but now it was mixed with shame, regret over the way he'd behaved, his tenderness restored, as if the imminence of departure had forced a shift of perspective. He knew which end of the platform to stand for the smoking carriage, and we watched through the window as he heaved the stuffed blue and gold bag onto the overhead rack and pushed it in as far as it would go, then pushed again with both hands until it was jammed. He sat down next to the window and smiled, embarrassed by the attention. He pretended to ignore us, reaching into his plastic bag for his pipe and Daily Mirror, before he couldn't restrain himself any longer and broke into a grin, waving as the train first jolted then rolled north towards Leamington and Coventry. I was 14. I was still sleeping in the dressing room next to my parents. I hadn't wanted to sleep alone on the second floor, out of earshot. I hadn't wanted to risk the dark in rooms adjoining the other end, only a door between me and the eerie, uninhabited spaces of the King's Chamber, Long Gallery and Barracks. But my teenager's desire for independence got the better of my fear, and I moved upstairs to a room off the gallery with my elder brother Martin's old stereo and a plunder of his tapes and records. I took my adolescent grumpiness up here and didn't bother to turn the volume down when I heard tour groups moving along the gallery the other side of the white door. The guide's descriptions of 17th century glazing and plasterwork soundtracked by drums and electric guitars. After repeated warnings, Richard was expelled from the centre. Nowhere else would take him, given his record of violent behaviour. Now, whenever I came home from school, my brother was already there, his lethargy and lack of motivation worse than ever. He didn't wash or shave. He communicated through the same limited set of threatening expressions. Mind your own business. You should keep your mouth shut. I don't have to, you can't make me. He was having one or two general tonic-clonic fits every month, as well as several partial seizures. After one seizure, he sat in a chair, gripping the armrests. I'm shaking to pieces, he said. Things have been so horrible for me. He subsided in the days afterwards, without energy. The wind knocked out of him. Slowly his strength returns. There are still sunlit heron days when Rich helps Mum and Dad with castle jobs or smokes his pipe in the ladies' garden or wears his suit and a bow tie for a concert in the church, his hand on Mum's shoulder to engage her attention as he reports a pun. If somebody wanted a bodyguard and a gardener, couldn't they just have a bodyguardener? He came in through the back door into the hall, hands clasped together and held out in front of him as if he'd just trapped a butterfly in them. Where's Dad? He asked. I don't know, I said. What is it? It's a baby swift. We've got to call the vet. He opened his hands the way you'd imitate a book opening, and I saw the young swift lying motionless on his palm, wings flat against its body. I'd never seen a swift this close. It was tiny, grey. Its eyes were shut. It lay dead still. Rich was worked up, pacing back and forth, his brain racing. I'm going to call the vet. He went over to the telephone, then paused. He didn't know how to pick up the receiver and dial while he still held the baby swift in his hands. Will you call the vet? He asked. Tell them it's urgent. It's very important. Mr. Mulder's here to report on beech saplings in Frederick's Wood, stooping so he doesn't bash his forehead on the arch. He was the tallest man I knew, a totem pole in faded blue boiler suit and enormous mud-caked boots, with a soft voice and squiggles of blue veins in ruddy countrymen's cheeks. Sometimes I went with Dad and Mr. Mulder to look at trees, falling behind as they strode across fields, discussing proportions of blackthorn, hawthorn and hazel in hedges, or the best spots for planting new clumps or lines. I learned to recognise the smooth, pale grey bark and black buds of ash trees. the slender, pointed buds of beech, the fat treacle buds of horse chestnuts, and the leaves and habits of sycamores, field maples, cherries and limes, even as I felt the strengthening of some inner resistance to my father's knowledge and enthusiasms, because I was 15 and hungry for my own interests and attachments. A year passed before my parents found a place for Richard at another centre. Preliminary assessment reported frontal lobe damage. The psychologists talked about his diminished executive function, his inability to exercise self-control over his emotional or anger responses. My parents wrote letters telling Richard how important it was not to be rude or aggressive. They tried to make a connection between his good behaviour and the frequency of his visits home, but hardly a day passed without at least one violent or aggressive outburst, often physical. The police were called when Richard attacked a member of staff. Then a fellow resident attacked him. The cut in his head needed stitches. Another incident led to the police being called again, and Richard received his second official caution. By now his face was a ledger of injuries, a scar on his nose where a fit felled him on the angle of a friend's doorstep, another on his left ear where he'd been clocked full swing with a cereal bowl, a false front tooth that was smoother and whiter than all the rest, the old one knocked out in a soccer-related brawl. Mum tore a page from her notebook and wrote "Memo to Richard" along the top. "A list of things you might do, or that we might help to arrange, to make your life better. I want to make your life better." She suggested table tennis, games, music and singing. But then more news arrived from the centre. Richard had had another fight, this time with a female resident. He was ashamed of himself, full of regret. Mum drove to the centre and took Richard to the local police station. A constable led them past cells to an interview room. He said the interview would be recorded. Mum said Richard was at the centre in part because of aggressive behaviour associated with brain damage. She said he'd had a bad seizure in May, his drugs had been changed, and he'd hit the fellow resident while his medication was changing. The constable described the incident. "Do you remember doing this?" he asked. "To be quite honest," Richard said, "I don't remember much." "I knew it was a bad period. I saw Richard's moods and seizures. But I had my own life. I was busy at school, my head full of work, sport, music and plays. Anyway, I was used to the way my brother's presence could shift like weather from gentleness to threat, and then shift again." Richard would get up early on his birthday, appearing in the kitchen freshly shaved and washed, hair brushed, eyes sparkling, a celebration luster I recognised from Christmas and Easter. This August evening, he wore his suit with a waistcoat and black bow tie, his pipe cupped in his left hand. He looked on as we laid the table in the dining room. Mum put candles in the middle of the round rosewood table. Rich extended his Zippo with the flame ready before she'd even pulled her hand away. "The twins are here, our uncle and aunt too. Rich like a visiting head of state, guest of honour, proud and courteous, pulling a chair out for Mum and then pushing it beneath her with an excess of enthusiasm, the chair ramming her knees forward, so she sits down before she's had a chance to think about it. Voices sound different in this old room's wood and stone acoustic. Rich lights his pipe, draws in deeply and exhales. A cloud drifts over the table, tethered by ropes of darker candle smoke. "Do you remember the cautionary tales, Rich?" Dad asked.
"What, you mean Hilaire Belloc?"
"That's it."
"I do, yes," Richard said. "I wouldn't forget them, would I, Mum?"
"I don't think you would. Do you remember Jim?"
"There was a boy whose name was Jim," he began in a low, steady voice, an actor slipping into performance register. "His friends were very good to him."
He recited slowly, in an even tone, the lines drawn out, their rhythm emphasized, pride shining in his face. The whole table's attention focused on him.
his eyes twinkling with candle points. I didn't remember the poem. I'd never heard Richard recite it before. I found myself held in a double suspense, both wondering how the story was going to turn out, and if Richard's memory would carry him through to the end. Richard's grin broadens and glows as he reaches the last line, and we all break into applause. He's proud to be at the centre of such acclaim, but embarrassed by the attention, and I can see the happy tension in his face again, not sure if he should suppress or unleash his smile. He looks down at his plate and laughs. When he looks up, his eyes are glittering.
And tomorrow, Dan Stevens reads the final part of The Music Room by William Fiennes. It was abridged by Viv Beebe, and the director was Elizabeth Allard.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and time for drama now with a Wilkie Collins mystery. Then Mel Gedroych will be here with the 4 o'clock show, including this week's story, Jeremy Brown on Mars by Simon Cheshire. Later, the River Severn provides the powerful backdrop to the story of a young man trying to work out where he belongs in the human world. As the elvers thrive and churn the water's surface, there is danger lurking. Sargasso at 9:15. Now, Walter Hartwright has been reunited with his beloved Laura at what was, apparently, her graveside. It's time to get to the bottom of Sir Percival's secret and the mystery of the woman in white once and for all.
To others, Laura was dead. To others, it was Laura who had been buried beneath the marble cross in Limeridge churchyard. She was dead to her uncle, dead to those who knew her, save her sister Marion and me. She was dead in the eye of the law, and as a result her fortune had been given to her husband and to her aunt. She was dead. How, therefore, could she ever be Laura again?
The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. Dramatised for radio by Martin Wade. With Juliet Aubrey as Marion Halcombe, Emily Bruni as Laura Fairley, Toby Stevens as Walter Hartwright, Philip Voss as Count Fosco, Jeremy Clyde as Sir Percival, and Edward Petherbridge as Mr. Fairley. Episode 4.
We took the London train from Limeridge. Laura sat by my side, her poor innocent head laid trustingly on my shoulder.
She is asleep, I think.
Yes, the day's excitement has worn her out. Tell me, Marion, how much does she remember of what has happened to her?
Very little as yet. She knows that she left Blackwater Park and went by train to London and was met at the station by Count Fosco. And she was taken to a house and became very frightened. After that, she remembers nothing until the moment when she woke up in a small, brown-tiled room.
She had been drugged, one assumes, and taken to the asylum.
Yes. And the dress that she was wearing was not her own. It was a white dress.
It was Anne Catherick's.
It was. Laura had become the woman in white. And the woman in white, she had died. And under Laura's name was laid to rest at Limeridge, reunited with her beloved Mrs. Fairley.
Extraordinary. Almost beyond belief.
But the process of exchanging the two identities released Laura's money without the need to kill her, and at the same time preserved Sir Percival's secret. It was a brilliant plot, devised, no doubt, by Count Fosco.
If I am to search for Anne Catherick, I must know how to recognise the woman.
Oh, it's very easy to describe her. She bears a remarkable resemblance to Lady Glyde.
Well. But Marion, you yourself must have believed that Laura was dead. How was it you found her?
It was Anne Catherick I was looking for, of course, not Laura. I was hoping to discover Sir Percival's secret from her. Count Fosco had already written to my uncle stating that Anne Catherick had been found and had been put into the same asylum from which she had previously escaped, and warning that she might use her resemblance to Laura to claim Laura's identity. So I found the asylum and secured a meeting with the patient in the asylum grounds. She was pointed out to me by a nurse. She was walking in my direction. I saw her face. So like Laura's, I thought. So very much like hers. She caught sight of me. She stopped, amazed.
Marion!
She rushed towards me.
Marion!
Laura, Laura, it's you, alive!
Dearest sister! Oh, dearest sister!
The three of us took humble lodgings above a news vendor's shop in East London.